Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Hello, everybody. This is the Retail Focus Podcast, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling with you. First off, full disclosure up front, not going to be one of our traditional podcasts, not going to be as full of analysis, in part because we were planning on actually taking a little bit off, because if you heard our last podcast, Leighton was in Colombia. It was going to be difficult to kind of engineer things from there, but a lot of stuff happened this past weekend, so as soon as our schedules allowed, we got together, wanted to talk about a couple of things, but first, as we go through, I just want to remind everyone to like us, rate us, wherever you do listen to us, and also remind everyone that here in about 4 or 5 days, we'll have a full episode of Retail Focus to look forward to. As we kind of launch into the show, one of the things I'm most curious about, because Leighton, you sent me a lot of pictures as you were in Colombia, going to malls, shopping there. First, what areas of Colombia were you in? And then what was your overview of Colombian retail, if you will? Because that's not a retail area that we hear a lot about here in the U.S.
As someone from the U.S., you're supposed to say Medellin, but it was actually pronounced Medellin, Colombia. I went there for about 4.5 days. Thanks to BioAccelerator, I got some stem cell treatment. And I have to say, Trent, they told me to stay in the hotel just because, you know, of safety precautions and the treatment dynamic there at the hotel. But I ended up leaving the very first day because I just had to see what that retail dynamic is like in Medellin. And I have to say, in El Poblado, which is a sort of a new affluent district there with a lot of millennials, a lot of tourists as well, there is a lot of retail, and a lot of it looks extremely similar to that which you would see in the United States. So, for instance, they have Domino's Pizza, they have Pizza Hut, they have Subway, they have a number of QSRs that are extremely visible, are extremely common here in the United States. But what was interesting is that we talk a lot about grocery stores, and the typical grocery store you would see here in the U.S. is big box, right? So you have Walmarts, you have Targets, you have a number of grocers that come from maybe Kroger's banners or Albertson's banners, but there you really only have one or two big box grocers. They're mostly independently run chains that specialize in only one or two things. So think of it like going back in time, maybe, and maybe visiting a meat market or perhaps getting your dairy delivered to your door. But it's interesting in that a lot of these specialty shops were extremely busy and everything was pretty well displayed. Merchandising was up to date. Everything was very clean in a lot of these areas. And I was highly impressed just the sheer amount of traffic going in and out of these stores. Obviously, a lot of these places have been in business for quite some time. But if we're speaking largely about just the overall dynamic, I was extremely impressed about how things were ran. And to be honest with you, Trent, I never even exchanged the dollar for the Colombian peso. I ended up only having credit cards, MasterCards, Visas, what have you. And I have to say, 9 out of 10 places I went, either for food or I'm going into different retail outlets to maybe tinker around and buy one or two souvenirs, they all accepted, or I should say 90% ended up accepting credit cards. So it was extremely easy. And of course, those credit card processing companies are going to do the conversion rates for you. And it's about, if anyone's wondering out there, 3,260 Colombian pesos to one US dollar. So I was constantly having to do math in my head, which is good because I'm trying to stay mentally sharp for things like the podcast. But overall, I have to say, extremely impressed, which, again, in my particular district, El Poblado, it really has something for everybody. And I think it really would behoove a lot of people to tour areas like that and get a different perspective on how different things are ran. And we're not just talking retail, we're talking about the overall picture of it. Traffic is very different. The rules are very different around there in those parts of the country. And I think overall, Trent, it was a very eye-opening experience and one that I come away with a very positive feeling with.
So let me ask you a couple of questions here. You talked a little bit about grocery retail and that type of thing. My first question is, what's general merchandise retail like there? Because we know there are a lot of QSR chains that are repeated. Is general merchandise pretty similar to the U.S., or was it different in a way, in the same way that grocery was kind of specialized?
It's actually a really, really good question because I primarily just touched on grocery just then. I will say general merchandise retail falls under the banner of maybe a little bit of mixture with those big box grocery stores. So within those big box grocery stores, you're going to see a lot of paper goods items like paper towels and so forth, and then also health and beauty items. So things that you would see in those larger stores, such as the aforementioned Kroger stores. But as far as larger general merchandise, something akin to maybe a Walmart or a Costco, those stores really do not exist. And what was interesting is that Medellin is actually one of the three biggest cities in Colombia. You have Bogota, and then you also have Cali. With approximately 2.9 million people in Medellin, you would expect something a little bit different, something like a big box store, because those types of chains do exist in South America, and they certainly do in Central America and Mexico, where Costco is beginning to have a presence, and of course Walmart has had a presence in Mexico for quite some time. But that was very interesting because it's just like I was saying with the dynamic with certain grocery items, how you may have a niche store with just maybe selling meat or selling a particular type of produce. But you would also see specialty shops selling things, maybe storage containers and things of that nature, really specializing in one or two categories rather than going in one-stop shop. You see everything displayed like you would in a very large 100,000 square foot format like you would in a Walmart here in the States.
And so my next question is this. I love the fact that you referenced kind of the historical way of retail in the U.S. because if you look back, you're right, things were very split out. You would have produce markets, you would have meat markets, especially when it came to fresh goods. You know, looking at kind of like the five and dime type thing, those were the first type of stores that kind of collected everything together, those dry goods stores. And then you had Kmart and Walmart and Alco and all of those kind of pop up, Gibson's as well, pop up, where suddenly everything became homogenized. Do you think we're in a circumstance where American retailers might be able to take a page from some of those retailers in Colombia and become a little bit more specialized? Do you think there's a market for that in the U.S.?
Yeah, the answer I'm going to give you is really taking sort of a different look at the infrastructure between the two countries. So obviously, Colombia has had a massive resurgence in the last 15, 20 years. It's been well documented. And it's interesting because before going there, Trent, I had to explain to a number of my friends and, of course, family members that it is, in fact, safe there. It is, in fact, safe to travel there and walk around freely because of all of the movies and TV shows that you see, everything that you've seen in the news historically would really paint a very poor picture of the region. But I have to say it's exactly the opposite, at least again in my particular experience. But with that, with the history of that particular region comes sort of aging infrastructure where you may only have one or two lane streets. It's very hard to get by in high traffic times. So as it relates to retail in the U.S., I think the U.S. is always going to be just inherently different because of our highway systems, of our road networks, and of a lot of other things we have going on that really enables those big box stores to flourish. And so I think we could take a few pointers to your point, to your question of maybe Colombian retail in terms of maybe, again, having more niche stores. You're seeing that with eyeglass shops now coming up and really straying away from the e-commerce space. A lot of specialty shops are popping up, but by and large, I think the U.S. really doesn't have much more room to evolve, whereas Colombia, if they enhance their infrastructure long-term, they definitely could actually take a lot more pages, I believe, personally, out of the U.S. retail handbook. I think it would be a lot better suited for the newer, younger customer that they have, the resurgence of a lot of tourism in that particular region, because right now, as it stands, a lot of people don't know, unless you're highly familiar with that area, where to get certain items. So if you're moving there for the first time, there is definitely a learning curve. But I think in due time, especially after speaking with all of the locals there in Medellin, they were saying that a lot of people from America or even any place in North America, particularly Canada, are actually flocking there because they like the conversion rate between the Colombian peso and the American dollar. And so a lot of people are actually retiring in that area because they can retire at a lot earlier age. But as a result, I think in due time, full service restaurants, quick service restaurants, and general merchandise retail, they will evolve. And I think they're really going to be tailored towards that end customer. I think it's extremely important for those local officials to realize that the population's only going to go up from here, and there's a lot of positivity around the region. It really behooves them to enhance that infrastructure, maybe get some better roads. They are working on enlarging a metro system that is really huge throughout the central part of the city. A lot of people ride it, and it's actually fairly new. It's very reliable. It's very nice. A lot of good remarks regarding the plans that they have in place. It's just whether or not they can actually put those in place, have it executed well, and then have the infrastructure surrounding those larger projects in order to facilitate better retail in the future.
All right. So good insight. I appreciate you answering and humoring some of my questions there, but I think it's of interest to a lot of our listeners, certainly, who probably aren't planning on going to Columbia anytime soon, just kind of what the retail landscape looks like there. And a lot of times when we talk about the retail evolution in the U.S., we're talking about moving towards e-commerce, not necessarily things changing in brick and mortar. Changing gears somewhat, you know, 88% of financially successful people read at least 30 minutes per day. They're hungry for knowledge. They continuously seek self-improvement and learning every chance they get. And our partner Blinkist gets you there faster than you can imagine. Now, if you're like me, this is something I've said before on the podcast, the list of books that people have recommended that I read or that I want to read, that's a never-ending list of books. I actually have piles of books next to my bed, always expecting to read those, and that pile is ever expanding. I don't have time to read them all. You probably don't either, but our sponsor Blinkist has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all.
Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most impactful elements. So you can read or listen to them in just under 15 minutes, all from your phone. And with Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in just those 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere. I like to listen to Blinkist while I'm at work or driving, maybe to go work out. A lot of downtime in the car now that I live in California. And honestly, Trent, my mind is really wondering a lot of the time. And I think these types of books that they have in their profile, extremely helpful in order to get your mind moving. The Blinkist library is massive, from timeless classics like Freakonomics to current Amazon bestsellers like Getting Things Done. And to be honest with you, Trent, my personal recommendation to check out is The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Everybody is talking about that particular book right now. There's a lot of podcasts based on the ideas within that particular book. A must-have if you're a Blinkist subscriber.
And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist is a special offer just for the Retail Focus podcast audience. Go to Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. Again, that's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. You can cancel at any time. No obligation there. Blinkist.com/retail. Well, speaking of brick and mortar, the main reason we got together to do kind of a quick show today is hashtag Target Down or Tarmageddon or whatever you want to call it. Target had an absolutely awful weekend that might cost them dearly financially. And the most severe issues took place Saturday with a completely unassociated aftermath rippling through on Sunday. To our surprise, the outages that likely cost millions in sales had no appreciable impact on the share price when trading reconvened earlier this week. Shares just fell less than 1% in trading on Monday as Wall Street kind of tried to figure out what might be the longer-term impacts from this issue. So that brings us to what happened. Well, according to Target, an internal IT failure caused registers and self-checkouts to be unable to scan products. The failure also affected associates' mobile units and inventory systems, meaning that employees couldn't use those to ring up stranded customers either. So as such, long lines gathered, pictures being posted on social media everywhere, some people waiting for nearly an hour before being able to check out. Associates basically had to process transactions by hand or by cell phone, manually entering each product sold. So as a result, long, long lines, a lot of carts being abandoned there. The outage lasted for around 2 hours, although based on the social media play it got, you would have thought it was for days. And at one point, many Target locations began to either temporarily close or send associates out to flag people down before they entered the store. So when we heard of the outage, you and I were texting back and forth. You immediately went to an Orange County Target, and there was an associate turning people away at the door. And because of the duration of the outage and no quickly implemented backup plan, a lot of people abandoned their carts. So this forced Target to use employees to attempt to deal with what are called returns carts quickly. They're not always returns, just sometimes abandoned items, that type of thing, in an effort to mitigate potential spoilage on perishables. So, Leighton, when you went to that Orange County Target, what did you see?
Yeah, another interview question, Trent. I really appreciate it. No, but in all honesty, I really appreciate the fact that when something like this happens, neither one of us are that far away from a Target. So it was really easy for me to get in my car, go to a Target near where I live, or actually a little bit further from where I live. It's not the most convenient Target, but I was really curious to see how and where it was affecting the Target stores. It turns out it was pretty much everywhere in the United States, but this particular store was in Tustin, California. It's sort of a suburb of Irvine. It's in between Costa Mesa, Irvine, and maybe you can throw out Newport Beach there. But as soon as I drove up, you could see three different associates talking, almost consoling diehard Target fans, telling them about the problems they were having with the point of sale systems inside the store. And to be honest with you, Trent, it looked as though it was all hands on deck as far as explaining to people what was going on and really apologizing, trying to make people feel a little bit better about maybe the future outcome and that maybe they could shop at the store later that day. But I went to another store in Anaheim just about 2.5 hours later on a very long bicycle trek, and I was very curious to see if another Target store was opened, and it was in fact opened. However, midway through me actually being inside the store, seeing how the general operations were, come to find out most or at least half of the items, according to management there, were not ringing up appropriately. And so now we know it had maybe more to do with the payments that the customers were using versus the actual different UPCs throughout the different items in the store. Regardless, a massive headache for those coming into the store on this particular day, trying to expect a normal transaction. Not very good, especially and not a good look once you're saying everything is fine, you can come into our stores now, and then, oh wait, it's not, you can only use cash to pay for your goods. And what's even worse, Trent, then on Sunday, an unrelated outage with vendor NCR caused many registers to be able to take payment for around 90 minutes. So people were thinking, not again, hopefully this is not going to be a reoccurring theme for the company. Data scientist Mike Kearney noticed a spike of hashtag Target down Twitter mentions as this started on Sunday and noted that his Columbia, Missouri Target was unable to process card payments. This problem was far less widespread and caused much less of an issue as the NCR hiccup was isolated to just one of their data centers. Good news for Target. According to customers, Target was able to process cash and gift card transactions during this time, sort of similar to what we saw on Saturday, but several customers went to the resident ATM to withdraw money and complete the transactions they were intending on completing when they walked into the store. So, Trent, what are the impacts, do you think, here for Target? CNBC's Lauren Thomas quoted two different interviews in her article last week.
Yeah, so finally, you're the one asking me a question there. But yeah, no, Lauren Thomas mentioned Jonathan Triber of RevTrax, who estimated a chain-wide outage for a full day would be $200 million, and that the outage they experienced this weekend cost Target easily nine figures. Now, in just doing the math, again, one day, $200 million, a two-hour outage, doesn't seem like the math adds up there for nine figures. So it might be misleading, potentially incorrect, as a two-hour outage followed by, and keep in mind, the outage on Sunday was 90 minutes and it was card only. It doesn't seem like it adds up to $100 million or more, just according to his firm's single-day estimates. Stacy Widlitz of SW Retail Advisors, another person quoted in the article, basically said that it was a negative experience for the shoppers, but that shoppers generally have short memories. Apex Marketing, also cited in the article, found that there was about $16.2 million worth of brand exposure between social media and internet news. Of this, $8.9 million was estimated to be negative, $1.1 million positive, and $6.1 million neutral. Really, this means about $7.2 million in positive exposure, because honestly, if we're being clear here, there's no such thing as neutral exposure as a retail brand. Your name gets out there. That's usually good exposure. Now, I don't agree that any news is good news, and kind of the Oscar Wilde type mindset there of, you know, hey, nothing is negative publicity, but certainly neutral mentions usually benefit a brand more than not. So some of our takeaways from this last weekend, I think from a PR perspective, Target did its best to mitigate it, although I found it interesting that they didn't really release a statement on their website or some sort of kind of acknowledgement outside of social media that this was going on. One thing Target did do, and it was certainly appreciated, it seemed like, by customers on social media, the Starbucks locations in the Targets were giving out free samples or free drinks. They were giving people water, almost like they were stranded on a desert island or something like that. But Target associates did a really good job, I think at least, of attempting to mitigate any potential negative PR. And so I think ultimately when you look at the response by Target on the PR front, they did some good things to control. They were kind of in crisis communication mode there. They did some good things to try and control the PR message. However, there was no backup plan outside of creating that positive PR. And I think that's worrisome if you have all of your registers across the country tied into one IT piece of infrastructure. That is a really dangerous circumstance. And I go back to my experience at, you know, Kmart, and this was years ago. Even Kmart had a backup plan for if their systems were to fail. And granted, it wasn't something that we ever had to use, but at least employees were cognizant of that backup plan. Here, it just didn't seem like, other than manual transactions, Target had much. Of course, that financial cost, I would say probably in the neighborhood of $50 to $90 million that you'll see, maybe in terms of the top line revenue. Again, that's just a best guess on my part, but I think $50 to $90 million is what you're going to see as the potential financial cost. But remember, it's not like everyone abandoned their carts, and that's kind of the assumption that Treiber had made earlier when he came out in that CNBC article, is that they lost all the sales during that two-hour period, and that wasn't the case. It was just that sales were much, much slower. Some people did persevere through that. And as Leighton mentioned, some people were turned away at the door. So obviously you're not getting any benefit from sales there, but it's not like they lost 100% of the sales during this point in time. One of the other things to think about, of course, also is product shrink. So anytime that you have a large amount of returns carts in a short period of time, this happens also on Black Friday. A lot of the busier shopping days during the holiday season, people are more likely to abandon their carts, especially if they just went on a so-called Target run for milk, for bread, that type of thing. You're going to have some shrink in relation to those perishables there. And then also staffing costs on those days, because a lot of times retailers, and what we learned, this is no different with Target, retailers asked employees to work a little bit longer, so you're not making as much money, and you're also paying employees for a few more hours. So that could also produce some long-term effects. Am I leaving anything out there?
I think you pretty much covered it all, Trent. I would say with the PR side of the business, I think that overall Target will rebound, to your earlier point, and to pretty much a lot of analysts out there believing in the Target brand and thinking that this was really just a few hours of overall downtime, a few days, maybe a week maximum of bad publicity. I just think the one thing going forward is that Target cannot have this happen again. And what really struck me as odd or coincidental is that there were two separate things that happened back to back that occurred and really ended up doing the same thing, preventing transactions from happening. So whatever those causes were, they need to really focus on being able to make sure these events do not happen again. I know that's easier said than done, but this is a company that, mind you, not that long ago, just a few years ago, had a terrible crisis on their hands in terms of managing customers' data. We all remember that fiasco with their credit card. That's why their systems are much more secure now. But when something like this happens, it's not just you and I that remember back a few years ago to when they had those larger issues and to think, well, are these related to maybe what happened back then, or are they not? So it's not just going to be us. It's going to be some of their most common customers thinking those things about Target. So in terms of the PR push right now, it's not going to be that negative, but they need to stay on top of this. All of the technology side is extremely important to make sure that you have in-house, that you understand all of your systems, that there are redundancies in place in order to prevent these things from happening, and most importantly, prevent the bottom line and top lines from being negatively affected for your shareholders.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, to close out today's show, we're going to do an abbreviated looking ahead here. And in this case, we're going to look ahead to stories that we're going to cover on this week's larger podcast. I want to look ahead to a story that came out regarding Amazon this past weekend. Numbers were crunched by Retail Dive, among others, that showed that the percentage of sales by third-party sellers was a whopping 58% in 2018, meaning not a whole lot of first-party sales for Amazon. But what's more is these exact numbers that came back all the way out in April, it's caused some analysts to kind of rethink where Amazon sits in the marketplace and revise those numbers to a negative fashion. Not very often we see that surrounding Amazon. Leighton, what's the story you're looking ahead to?
My looking ahead actually has to do with something I saw here recently with the Grocery Outlet IPO. And a lot of people may not be too familiar with Grocery Outlet. They're a, guess what, grocery outlet. They sell groceries in a big box format. And they compete with the likes of Kroger. So in the West Coast area, you're competing with Ralph's, with Albertsons, those kind of grocers that are very well known. So Grocery Outlet Holding Corporation ended up raising a ton of capital, more than they had anticipated. They raised around $378 million. And a lot of people were saying this was the above range IPO hit. So overall, the company executives should be extremely proud about this particular moment. And if you look at this supermarket, Trent, it's not going to be like the ones I just mentioned, although they are direct competitors. They sort of have a different profile. So, for instance, their price point is going to be a little bit less. Their value offering is going to be a little bit more. Their selection is going to be a little bit less. And so is their footprint. So while they have amassed normal sections, like you would see coolers, freezers, that type of thing, a produce section, all of the normal sections you would see in your down the street supermarket, it's all just a little bit smaller, a little bit more compact. They don't have as many brands, so not as much differentiation. But it's interesting, Trent, because people really adore this type of concept, especially in the lower income areas of the United States. I think this type of concept really actually is rivaling that of Family Dollar, Dollar General, those dollar stores, 99 cent store, that can actually offer the same type of groceries below maybe the $10 range. And so I think right now you're seeing the fact that this trading debut, how well it did, speaks to the idea that there is much more demand for this type of value offering within this supermarket arena. And I think right now, Trent, seeing the shares closed up around 30% to $28 a share this Thursday, that values the company at $2.44 billion. So for all of those looking at previous grocery valuations, particularly with Kroger, who has maybe a net of around 2 to 3% of revenue, you're seeing that maybe the grocery market really hasn't taken a backseat to more exciting retail, and there is more innovation to come in this particular area. And I think Grocery Outlet, if you're looking right now, Trent, those shares, yes, they're trading a little bit high according to several different multiples, but this is going to be a grocer that's supposedly going to put that money to work. They have over 300 stores. I'm curious to see what they do in terms of remodeling, expanding their footprint, perhaps doing other initiatives like we've seen with Kroger, where they enhance employee benefits and they enhance their sustainability measures in order to give a better public persona. And I think, Trent, this is really good, not only for the executive team, which are obviously celebrating that 30% pop this week, but just overall in terms of grocery branding, this does a lot in the competitive landscape, a landscape that has already been really, really tight with grocers like Walmart and Target saying that they will compete to the bitter end on price. This really does add a new wrinkle in this game, especially for the West Coast.
And you have to wonder if Albertsons isn't kicking themselves looking at the relative success of this IPO saying, well, probably should have done that earlier, although I don't think it would have been as well received had Albertsons come out with their IPO. Well, that'll do it for this truncated edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Again, for more, you can check us out on Twitter or Instagram at Retail Podcast. And we'll be back with you with a full-sized episode a little bit from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.